morning, everybody, and Mary and Glenn Coble, and this is A Progressive Life, and looking forward to today for the whole week, because I found out, and as those of you who are friends of mine that the internet, you know that I have a guest on today. My guest is Mike Larson, who has done everything under the sun, I think. After reading your, I got to make sure, are you on the air now?
Hi, Glenn, can you hear me?
I think I got had you on the wrong one.
Oh, okay, there we go.
There we go. That's the problem with, I used to be in radio. I even was an engineer in radio.
Oh, yeah.
And the new stuff is completely different. But yeah. Mike has done everything under the sun. In my bio, I say that I'm a master of, I have many traits, but I'm not good at any of them. But Mike has been excellent in three or four fields, and I'm totally impressed. Mike, you grew up, I guess you were born in San Francisco.
Born in San Francisco.
And then moved to San Bernardino.
San Bruno, which is really, that's where the airport is.
Oh,
so
okay.
it's just south of San Francisco.
So you're really a San Franciscoite.
Yeah, I'm a city kid. Still root for the teams.
Yeah.
My family still lives there.
My son roots for your team.
Oh, yeah.
I don't understand that, but since he's from Chicago. But anyway, Mike, you live in Plain City now.
Live in Plain City. Moved there about a year and a half ago.
He's a writer, a comedian, and a political operative. I couldn't think of any other word than political operative.
It sounds very more exciting. Sure.
It almost sounds like you do something under the
That's right. Like I'm going to be investigated someday.
Yeah. Mike helped me out when I was running for office last term, when I ran for a state representative. He also was very active in Janet Garrett's campaign. Yeah. And all of us Democrats appreciate what you did for Janet. She was a good candidate in a pretty gerrymandered state.
Oh yeah. Yeah, well it's you know, these seats in places like Ohio, you know, where it's just drawn so unfairly.
Absolutely.
And so the people who run, and including you, you know, it's a little bit of being a martyr, you know. The deck is stacked against you, but it would be wrong to let, you know, a guy like Jim Jordan run unopposed and have no one at least holding his tiny feet to the fire, you know.
His tiny feet. Yeah, he is a pretty small guy.
Right. Yeah, they said Napoleon had a Jim Jordan complex.
Indeed he does, or did. Anyway, I was in the 86th district down by
right.
Where you are.
Yeah.
And it was pretty gerrymandered. I went out to Dublin because mm-hmm. I figured that in Dublin I would get more response
right.
than in Marysville mm-hmm. and Marion because mm-hmm. Pretty stacked against our deck up in these
yeah.
parts of the woods. But anyway, got through it. Got about 30% of the vote. That
right.
wasn't very good, but I enjoyed it. And
it was surprising to me that so that was the first Ohio election that I was here for,
mm-hmm.
And I knew that it was an uphill slog to try to you know, take on an incumbent Republican. But I was shocked at how stacked it is. How there are places in central Ohio where having a D next to your name is a disqualifier right off the bat.
Absolutely.
You know, even Sherrod Brown, who everybody loves, you know, was getting horrible numbers in some of the most rural counties.
Yeah.
And it's I think local Democrats have to find a new strategy.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not enough to just pull a trailer in the parade with some old Democrats sitting in chairs and think it's going to change people's minds.
Well, I ran next to, if you recall,
yeah,
down in Marysville, I ran next to the trailer rather than sitting in a chair.
I was impressed. Yes, you talked to everybody, which is important. Yeah, right.
I tried hard.
Yeah.
Anyway, you helped with Jackie Speer, her campaign. Tell
yes.
us a little bit about how was
so,
it out there.
Well, I've known Jackie since I was 18 years old. And, of course, her story is, you know, in 1978 when Leo Ryan, the congressman from California, was shot and killed in Jonestown, Guyana. Jackie was his aide who was with him.
Yes.
And she was shot five times herself and left for dead.
Yeah.
And
I saw her story.
Was bleeding 23 hours on the tarmac in this before she even got medical attention. It was a miracle that she survived. I met her right before that trip. I was 18 years old. I was a local volunteer, a little political, you know, kid, and had volunteered for Leo Ryan's campaign and met her. And then when she came back, the first election she won, which was county supervisor, I was very involved in that. And so we've been friends ever since. She's my daughter's godmother. And I've always written things for her just as kind of a friend. And then when she got elected in 2008 in a special election when Congressman Tom Lantos passed away, she asked if I would come to Washington. So I took a break. At the time, I was writing for television, but I took a break. My wife and I, we sold our house, moved to D.C. My wife ran her front office, and I ran her press shop.
Huh.
And it was great. By far one of the best experiences of my life.
And she's still very outspoken.
She's awesome. She is not a... People ask how she is to work with. Jackie is very demanding, but she's great to work with because she's fair, but she's tough. Mm-hmm. You know, what you want your congressperson to
a
be.
A lot of them are that way.
Yes. And, you know, she does not handle slackers well. She's been through so much stuff so that nothing you can complain about is going to impress her.
Yeah.
You know,
well, just for the Marianites,
yeah,
that don't know who she is,
right.
She's the congresswoman from
represents a suburban district just south of San Francisco. Okay. She has a sliver of San Francisco, but it's basically, San Francisco is the northern border, and Silicon Valley is the southern border. So she's San Mateo County, which is was always just kind of a bedroom community for San Francisco because of, you know, the tech boom. Now it's an incredibly expensive place,
yeah,
but
it's
where I grew up.
Okay,
that area.
Well, I noticed that she's become kind of a favorite on the Talking Head shows.
Yes,
and that's good. She
yes.
always speaks very clearly and speaks her mind.
And she speaks her mind. That's
yeah.
right. She's very outspoken, but also very articulate. Has a good sense of humor. You know, all the kinds of things you would want on, you know.
Nice segue there. That lets me jump into your humor.
Yeah.
You wrote for Bill Maher, who is one of my favorites.
Okay, yeah.
How was that? Well, I imagine he was kind of demanding.
Bill is very easy to write for because you know what he wants,
okay,
which is good in a boss. He is not a warm and fuzzy kind of guy, but
he doesn't appear to be warm and fuzzy.
Well, I found interesting for, you know, he had this show, and then before he has had this show, he had
Real
Politically
Time.
Incorrect.
Oh, yeah.
This one's Real Time. Over those 20 years of doing a political comedy show, I was the first writer he ever had that had actually ever worked in politics.
Huh.
And it was funny. Some of the writers who were really, really brilliant guys had some very basic questions about how a bill becomes a law and, you know, the mm-hmm. committee process and things that, you know, most people don't understand. But it was interesting. But I had a good time. I was there for a few years and got an Emmy nomination out of
yeah,
it.
I
so,
saw that.
Yeah,
I think it was like 2011 and 12. Would that be right?
I think so.
Yeah,
yeah,
somewhere around that time.
Yeah, and I had written for a number of other, you know, television comedies, but that was the first time I got to kind of combine politics and comedy.
You wrote for Drew Carey, and Ellen,
mm-hmm.
and Reba. Those are just a few of the
yeah.
names that Mike's written for.
Yeah.
Are they all? I assume they're all different. Who is the easiest? Well, let's say who is the toughest to work for?
Oh, well, so
she or he won't.
So there are people who are very tough. But for instance, I work with Whoopi Goldberg, who is very tough, but it's all about the show with Whoopi. And then I worked with people who were horrible, like Brett Butler on Grace Under Fire, or, I mean, Reba was not an easy person to work for. My problem with someone like Reba is that it seemed to be more about her personal comfort that she would get angry about, rather than it being about the show. You take a guy, someone like Ellen or Drew Carey or Whoopi, consummate professionals. Yeah. So yeah, they can be tough if you're not delivering what they want you to deliver, but it was always about the show.
Cross your T's and dot your I's, but not so much of what type of
and bring the time. Funny, bring the funny, yeah. Right? They don't care, right? The other stuff they don't care that you didn't look them in the eye or whatever, and the other nonsense that can happen with people have an overblown ego.
Yeah.
Ellen is just incredible. In an entire season, I don't think I ever saw her flub a line a single time,
which is just
and very often we were feeding lines. Right there, you know, there's you cut, you run onto the stage and say, "Hey, how about this joke?" She gets she does it every time.
I'll be
there. She's
I remember when she came out,
uh-huh.
and I was scared to death for her that it wasn't going to work, but she pulled it off pretty darn well. And now we have a presidential candidate who is gay, and I love to see that. One of the things that makes me so proud and so happy of where I stand is, I don't care if you're gay or black or purple or what, and I do enjoy everybody.
That's the great thing about a guy like Pete Buttigieg is that people, you don't care, especially young people.
Yeah.
There's so many young people who are like, why do we care? I don't, personally, I've never been anyone, has ever cared what anyone does behind closed doors, as long as they're not hurting anybody. I don't want to know what my friend's sex life is. Yeah. I don't care if you're married to the most beautiful woman on earth. I don't need to know the particulars. We all understand how it works. And that would be the best thing, that people are just taking him at face value. For me, it's weirder that he's a mayor than that he's gay. To have a mayor of South Bend running for president is weird to me.
I love it because I went to South Bend Central and South Bend Adams High School.
Oh, that's right. I forgot you were from there.
And when they go back to pictures of South Bend, I go, oh, yeah, I remember that. Uh-huh. Or I go, I don't remember that at all. It's really changed in a long time. But do you have a favorite this year?
That's in the race now?
I didn't say a favorite, but do you have somebody that you're really kind of following more?
Like many people, I was disappointed that Sherrod Brown didn't get in.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't, because I want him to stay
in the VR. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's true. I really like Kamala Harris.
Do you?
I know her a little bit from San Francisco politics. I've always liked her. People who know in San Francisco comment on how similar she is to Jackie Speier, to my old boss. Mm-hmm. The way she carries herself, the way she speaks. I think she was
very direct.
Kind of a bit of a devotee to Jackie as she came up. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that's just naturally someone I'm going to like, because it's familiar to me. She's very smart. We have a lot of good people running.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
By the way, Mike's probably a Democrat.
Yes, I am.
My listeners.
I like to tell people that I would describe my political leanings as a progressive / hypocrite.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the things that I believe in that I don't live by. I hate animal cruelty, but I love meat. Things like, you know.
I hear you.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it, you know, I still do stand-up comedy. I did a show Friday night, in fact, in Powell. And for me, the problem with our politics isn't that we are divided. It's that so few people just don't have a sense of humor about it.
Yeah.
I have very good friends who are very, very conservative, and people are shocked sometimes that we're friends, and they say, how can you be friends with so-and-so? And it's like, well, we like each other, so we don't piss each other off. We don't we don't bring up stuff that
you know where the buttons
we'll
are.
We'll have a discussion. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. My neighbor is a very, very conservative Republican, and he, you know, we met because I had a giant Janet Garrett sign in my yard, and he came over and asked, you know, what I was doing. He thought because I just moved, I didn't know better. And I was like, no, I know who Jim Jordan is. Believe me, that's why I have that sign there. Yeah.
Well, as I told you before we got on the air, I am toying with the idea, and my audience knows this, I'm toying with the idea of running against Jim Jordan. That is, if nobody else jumps in. But I'd like to hear what you think about an old white guy running for office anymore. Now, when I first... I was asked who.
Wait a minute, you're white?
Well, I'm kind of gray. But when I was first asked who I would vote for, I said Kamala Harris and the oldest guy in the race,
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden.
Uh-huh.
And now I'm kind of switching over to Beto or. Buttigieg.
Uh-huh.
And but I'd love to see her in that duo somehow or other. But what do you think an old white guy like me can say? And I know that there are a lot of people that don't want, because I had a lady tell me down at a show that I did for Women of Action. She said, I wasn't going to vote for you. And I said, why not? She said, you're an old white guy.
Right, right.
And I said, well, what changed your mind? She said, I listened to you.
Right. Well, I was very impressed. You know, we cross paths quite a bit at candidates' nights.
Yeah.
And you are very good on the stump. You're a very natural. You're a good speaker.
When you make a commitment not to lie, it's a lot easier to remember what you say.
Yeah, and you are someone, you know... To run for Congress it's daunting. It's even in a normal district. Then you take this stupid, giant duck-shaped district that the Republicans gave to Jim Jordan because he could not win in a fair district. He's universally hated in Washington. Republicans don't like him. He's famous for not being very bright. He doesn't do his homework. There are some very bright Republican congresspeople who do their homework. Mm-hmm. He is not one of them.
Well, I've been told he's losing a little ground up in his own area up north.
His area is what? Is Urbana.
Yeah,
and in
Urbana
fact, whenever Janet went there, he would, people would come up and I can't tell you how many people said, I'm related to Jim Jordan. That's why I'm voting for Janet Garrett. I would encourage you to run. Sure, if there is someone out there in the district who is independently wealthy and you know can spend millions of dollars against Jim Jordan, that would be awesome.
Yes,
I don't think that's going to happen.
No. I noticed that Eric has and Janet have been involved in trying to develop a pact against him. I don't know whether.
Yeah. I know. I haven't been involved with that, but right, they have a Facebook page of Jim Jordan or something. Jordan Watch, I think they call it.
Yeah.
Which is great, and I'm sure whoever runs will have, Janet will certainly help, and she is just one of the most sincere people I think I have ever met.
I think that hurt her.
Right.
She wasn't tough enough. She got tougher as the campaign went along, and you and the rest of the group that was in there probably helped her get that way.
That was what...
It was tough for her.
The biggest thing I did for Janet was work on her stump speech and build up her confidence. She had run, twice before and was still... When I met her, it was like she was asking permission to run.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, no, you... I don't care how long someone's been in Congress. They don't own that seat. They have no more right to that seat than anybody else does. And you have to have that attitude. And that's why I think if you ran, you have nothing to lose. You would take it to him. And I think whoever runs, the single biggest issue is Jim Jordan. Jim Jordan is not qualified to be in Congress. I don't care how long he's been there. You talk to people in Washington, even Republicans, and they shake their head because he's lazy. He doesn't do the work. He doesn't read up on issues. He's just this little attack dog. He's like a little chihuahua.
He is,
you know, exactly. Trying to defend the president. And
was it was it you or a friend of yours that developed the Muppet?
Oh, the puppet, the little Jim Jordan puppet. So that was funny. My idea, and yes, so I wrote those spots, and then got a friend of mine named Tim Lagasse, who is one of the greatest puppeteers in the world, actually, who came up with Jim Henson. Mm-hmm. And I did a kids show with him years ago. And so one night I called and I said, I have this crazy idea. And I sent him a video of Jim, and he came back with that puppet that was just perfect.
Yes, it was right on.
Yeah. Now, we're going to be doing some more. He's Tim is in New York right now, but he has the JJ puppet with him, and we're going to be doing some more spots just for ourselves.
I would have loved to have seen it more on television, but I understand it was difficult to raise funds, especially going against Jim Jordan. I think with Jim Jordan, apparently a couple weeks ago, they announced that they were re-looking into the scandal with
the Ohio State thing.
And having been a former athletic director, I know that the assistant coaches know what's going on.
Yes.
And I'm thinking that maybe this is the time that he can be beaten, because people will start to see him for what he really is. And
maybe. I don't know that scandal is going to...
not going to go anywhere?
It's not like he is being accused of actually hurting any
no,
kids.
No,
it's just, he was probably, he was a wuss is the worst thing. He was scared to speak truth to power.
And yet
just like he has in right. He thinks he's so tough. Yeah.
He's a wrestler. He's a tough guy.
Yeah. Well, and he deserves whatever credit he gets for his wrestling career. I understand he was incredible at it.
Yes.
and good for him. I read his book. He wrote a book, and I found this very interesting, that when he first started out in wrestling in high school, he wasn't doing well in his weight class. So a coach told him that he should go down a weight class. So he did. He kind of starved himself so that he could go down a weight class, and he kept doing that until he got to the lowest weight class, where he was the biggest guy in the lowest weight class. Yeah. And if that does not describe his personality, he's a guy who has punched down his entire life, and he's always looking for a weaker opponent. He couldn't compete with the big boys, so he had to go find a smaller opponent, and I just thought that was so perfect. For just how he is in politics too, you'll never see him punching up. Never, no.
Well, I had a great friend in high school that did that. I think mm-hmm. it was a 98-pound class or 95,
right.
Whatever the lowest one
right.
was, and he kept going on diets and diets mm-hmm. and diets to the point where, and he was very good,
mm-hmm.
and he went to the state finals, I believe, and passed out and
couldn't compete.
Which is a shame. But I think I'm hoping Jordan will pass out this
year. Yeah.
Anyway, I noticed something on one of your bio things that I thought was amazingly interesting. You're a very friendly, very outgoing, very happy person, I believe.
For the most part, yes.
But you have taken it on yourself, or at least you did when you were out in California, to mentor inmates.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I still do. In fact, I just talked to a friend of mine who was paroled a few months ago. I was just talking to him the other day. San Quentin State Prison in California. The first time I went was when I worked for the congresswoman. We went for something, and when they found out that I was a writer, they invited me to come back and speak to their creative writing program. So I went back. I've probably gone, I don't know, 20 times now. It's great. The creative writing program is taught by this woman who's been doing it for years, and within the group, there are some brilliant writers, and there's some guys who are barely literate, just learning.
Gives them an outlet, though.
It does. And one thing I found fascinating, and I wish, one of the reasons why I was hoping Rich Cordray got elected is that I was hoping to get involved in the correction system here. And I would still like to, if anyone is out there, I would love to do that here, to work with inmates.
Well, this is the town to come to. We've got three
right,
prisons.
Right. Well, maybe, yes, maybe someone is connected to the one of the prisons. I would love to. The warden told us when I first went that, you know, the recidivism rate for the most part is around 2/3, around 60% for people who have been in state prison will end up back in the system within the next 5 or 10 years. But if they take one college level course, the rate drops to below 5%. It was crazy, the number.
Holy
and I forgot
cow.
What the exact number was. And he said the reason is partly the course, but mostly the internal change a person takes in order to get into one of those courses.
Unless you're finding a little success.
You probably. Don't get to go in unless you have decided, I'm not going on down that route. I'm going to do something else. And you know, sometimes it could be like a marketable skill like metal shop or something like that, or something like art or creative writing, or, you know, they have a Shakespeare company now at San Quentin. And it's incredible. And you meet these guys, and they're just so inspiring. And most of the guys, you know, they're in their 40s, 50s, serving time for something they did when they were 18 or 19, usually either involved with gangs or drugs. And it was poor. There's a few people there who grew up in privileged or middle-class backgrounds, but mostly not. Mostly right. It's poor. And so, you know, I talk in my act about, you know, could you imagine if your entire adult life was based on the stupidest thing you did when you were 19?
Yeah, oh my.
You know, I'd still be known as the streaker who couldn't hurdle a rose bush. You know?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I did that here in town when I was working for the local credit union. Mm-hmm. I would go out to one of our prisons, I don't remember which one, and give them a class on finance.
Oh, that's great.
We had a neat board game that they could play.
Oh, neat.
Standing up. And it was amazing. I had one guy come up to me almost in tears and tell me he was getting out. He had been in for 18 years for second-degree murder, I mm-hmm. believe it was. And he'd been in for 18 years, and he had no idea what he was going
right.
to do.
Right.
Because he had heard about things like the internet, and he had heard about things like handheld phones,
right?
But he hadn't seen
right.
them. So we started talking, and it was a good afternoon.
It's
but I felt so sorry.
It's very scary. I had a guy come up to me. He had been in for murder. He had been a Hell's Angel. He was a big, burly, you know, tough-looking guy. And he said he's about to get out, and he was scared to death for that same reason. He said there was no technology. He had been in for 30 years, had never used an ATM, had never used a cell phone, and he was scared to death. And I told him, I said, he was around my age, and I said, Stan, there's no reason, understand that anyone our age isn't supposed to know how that stuff works. I've never been in prison. I have no excuse. I don't know how any of that stuff works. You ask your... You know, you have a niece or a nephew? Ask them.
Yeah, 12-year-old.
And you'll be fine. Right. I have a 12-year-old daughter who teaches me that stuff. And it was so funny. He got this big smile, and he said, you have no idea how happy that makes me. And I said, it's nothing to do. Their fear is that if you say, I don't know how my phone works, they're going to say, what were you in prison?
Yeah.
No, you're just an old guy.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Just normal old guy
right,
stuff.
Right.
Well, I did forget to tell people. You can call in if you'd like to ask Mike a question or two. The number is 740-383-9944, or that's 740-383-WWGH. And we'll be glad to take any phone calls. But I wanted to get this going so we could talk about things. And then if somebody has a question
sure.
or two, I'm sure you'll entertain them. But,
sure.
Well, what are you planning? What's your future? What are you going to do?
Well, you know, I moved here with my wife and daughter because my wife, who's from Ohio, wanted to be closer to family, and my daughter wanted to be close to her cousins.
By the way, how'd you ever get such a good-looking wife?
Well, The good Lord, in his infinite wisdom, made hot women like guys with a sense of humor.
There you go.
I can tell you how many of my goofy-looking friends have beautiful wives or girlfriends.
I'm going to tell my wife that.
Yes, yes. It's not fair for them, but it's good for us. And
you came here because
I came here because the my writing career had changed. Most of my work is freelance work now, so I was able to write anywhere. I still go out to LA when I need to. So right now I'm looking for more work. Maybe there's someone out there who wants someone to ghostwrite their autobiography. I mean, that's what a lot of what I've been doing lately. A lot of ghostwriting. Huh. I still write speeches for politicians. I write stuff for a couple CEOs. There's a doctor out in Florida who writes, contributes a lot of articles to magazines, and I help her with those, edit them, and ghostwrite them a little bit.
Cool.
I love doing that. It's so much fun. And
I'll have to show you my. I have a book I've written called Memoirs of a Nobody.
Oh, okay.
And I'll have to. Ship that off to you. It's yeah, about no. 300 pages. It needs a lot of work.
Yeah, well, you know, most people, for one thing, it is hard to write your own story because you throw so many hurdles in the way. You know, I'm bragging. Maybe this isn't 100% how it happened. When you give it to someone who is writing it as a writer, I have no stake in that.
Yep.
There's so much more freedom. I can tell a story very often much more honestly because I don't have the
baggage.
I don't have right or the ego or anything else. Yep. And then that person can read it and say, okay, well, this part isn't exactly true. I'd like to fix this. I'd like to fix that. So
I can't tell you how many things I left out of my memoir because I wasn't exactly positive that I remembered it exactly the right way.
Right.
And they were good things.
Right. No, absolutely.
And I did put a little sex in it, too, and I had to be careful on that.
Yeah, well, I think most people, we don't remember things exactly how they happened.
Yeah.
And also, when we did something, there was no historical context to it. You did it in the moment.
Yeah.
So having a little bit of distance helps. There was someone I was helping write a book for that we did an interesting format where every other chapter was first person, was his, and then the odd chapters were from my voice, mm-hmm. Providing context and comment.
That's interesting.
And yeah, it was really, it was fun. It was an interesting format that worked for him because I was then able to kind of talk more about you know, doing some research into what really happened that might be different than how
he saw
they
it.
Might remember it. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a problem of mine. And the other problem I had is I went through it. I reread it two or three times and I kept saying, wait a minute, that didn't happen before this happened.
Right.
That happened way after this, but I had pulled it all together in my brain because it was somehow related.
Well, very often with the congresswoman, she would tell a story like about Jonestown, and then I would go back and research it and say, this was incorrect.
Yeah.
That's not the sequence of events. And she's like, oh, my God, she had no idea some of the things that had happened.
And that's not a lie when you don't remember it that way. It's just the way you remembered it.
Right. Yeah. Right. You were there in the moment. And yeah. Yeah.
So now you're still doing some stand-up comedy.
I do. As much as I can.
Where
I
do
love
you go?
It.
Where do you go? In Columbus,
at the Columbus Funny Bone quite a bit. Okay. I did a show on Friday night at a country club in Powell at Wedgwood Country Club. I love doing stand-up. You know, I've done it almost my entire life. And when I was young, I put so much pressure on myself to be a success that it wasn't as much fun. Now I do it for the sake of doing it.
Yeah.
I love it. And if I can give a little bit of a plug, people can always find me at writemikelarson.com, which is WRITE, Mike Larson. And Larson is spelled LARSEN. Mm-hmm. And you can, you know, if everyone needs to get in touch with me or find out where I'm performing or whatever. But,
Of the neat things on your website is there's a whole bit that you did on Jay Leno, which was
my first Tonight Show appearance on there. Yeah, that was fun. I'm glad I found that tape. Yeah, I did The Tonight Show in, I think it was 1995.
How many times did you do it?
I did it twice.
Okay.
And, yeah, it was great. The first time, I mean, it was, for many, many years, the gold standard for a comedian. Once mm-hmm. you did The Tonight Show, you made it, whether you were ever going to be rich or famous. It didn't matter. Within the fraternity of comedians, if you did The Tonight Show, especially when it was Johnny doing it. I did it in Jay's first year. Uh-huh. But it was a major moment, and it is still how I'm introduced when I go on stage.
Oh, yeah.
And when I was single, it was how I impressed women. In fact, I had the VHS tape of my first Tonight Show set, and whenever I had a girlfriend or someone coming over for dinner or whatever, I would always make sure that was visibly visible on the television, so people, oh, you want to watch that stupid thing? Well, all right.
Let's face it, guys are sleazeballs. I like to introduce myself now to young women. Oh yes, I ran for state representative.
Right, yeah.
I lost my butt, but right. I ran.
Well, I find it funny. Do people do this? When I was 19, I ran for my city council.
Yes, I saw.
And
that.
I funny when I tell people I ran for city council, and they say, "Did you win?" And I was like, if I won, wouldn't I have said I was on the city council? I wouldn't have said I ran. Obviously, I didn't win.
It's interesting how those of us who have run for office have ways of saying that they lost. And one of I lost about 5 or 6 years ago. I don't remember. I ran for state or city or county trustee.
Okay.
And the county here is very Republican. Uh-huh. And I knew the chances were slim, but I ran anyway because I thought we needed to get a voice out there. Right. But I only lost by 800 votes. And uh-huh. I tell everybody, I only lost by 800 votes. Right. Now, that was a third of the vote.
right.
But anyway, I do that. The part about campaigning that I love is going out and talking to the people, shaking their hands. I love the public speaking part.
Right.
The part I hate is the fundraising.
Oh, yeah.
And that's so tough.
Having to ask people for money is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially, they say, well, the state Democratic Party said, well, you start with your family. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, most of my family is past.
Right.
I'm the oldest Coble left on the planet.
Uh-huh.
And my kids, they don't have enough money to pay their own bills.
Right.
So that was kind of tough.
And especially when you were in a race where... You are not likely to win.
Yeah.
So it's
and my opponent just got $7,000 in dark funds.
Right. Yeah. Right. So
yeah, it was kind of tough. But the problem I had, and I'm going to be kind of critical here, I asked the state Democratic Party to send me a list of names of people that had donated to Democrats in the past mm-hmm. in my district. They said they would. I asked them three times. They never got me a list. And that was kind of frustrating. I would have gladly called those people, but they didn't send me the list. So anyway.
When I was a television writer and making really good money, we donated to a lot of candidates. So unfortunately, I am on a lot of these lists.
Yeah, I bet you are.
And I don't make a lot of money now. So I don't donate to candidates. I help candidates. I'm always happy to help. But you know, these people call and they'll start, "Hi, this is so-and-so. I'm running for Congress in Mississippi," wherever they're running. And I stop them and I say, "I'm going to stop you right there. 'Cause I know how valuable your time is. I can't, I'm on that list because I used to be able to give money to candidates and I don't anymore. I can't anymore." And I hate it. And I've asked, you know, all these different, like the DCCC in Washington and the DNC to please take my name off those lists, because I love all these candidates and I don't want them to waste their time on me. I love talking to them. But, you know.
What is the most unusual or the best response that you've heard to somebody being asked for political money?
Well, one guy, without skipping a beat, said And I said, I don't have money anymore. I just don't. I'm not a big earner. And I'm at a point in my life where I've got I have a child. I have grandchildren I need to give money to. I said, I help in other ways. And he said, all right, help me in another way. And I said, okay, great. Send me your stump speech. Send me a stump speech and I'll rewrite it for you. I'll help you out. And I did. And I was happy to do that. I love doing that. I mean, I think you sent me your stump speech or something to read over.
Tidbits on.
Yeah, that. Yeah, to give some. So I'm always happy to do those sorts of things. But you get called by like senators. When someone says, "Hi, this is Senator Sherrod Brown," and I'm like, "Oh my God, I'm so excited to talk to you, Senator." However, I don't have any money to give you.
Yeah.
Or like I donated to him, but I would rather buy a ticket to an event, then give money over the phone, because then you get something out of it. You get to meet the person and meet other people.
So many of those events are so expensive.
Right.
We just had a meet Nancy Pelosi opportunity, but it was going to cost me $250.
Right.
I'm on Social Security.
Right.
I don't have $250, right. But I would have certainly loved to go.
Right. Right. Yeah. No. And it's it is a problem with the system that we need money. You know, for Janet ended up raising about $500,000, which is a pittance in American politics, especially in a district this big when there's five different media markets. That is really what keeps me from running for office. Yeah. One is, I'm new to Ohio. I don't know that many people, But the amount of time where you have to ask money. If I liked asking people for money, I'd be rich right now.
Yeah, or you'd be a televangelist.
Right, right. Yeah.
Well, I that was one of the campaign stump speeches that I had. It was getting money out of politics.
Right.
Let's put all the advertising on PBS and stuff like that where it's free and. Not allow anybody to buy TV. I don't know.
Well, the great thing about now, young voters don't watch television anyway. Nope. They to the degree they watch television shows, they're watching them on their devices, and that is not expensive. In fact, that puppet videos that we did ended up raising quite a bit of money for the campaign. For the little amount that I was paid each week in order to work for Janet, those puppet videos alone probably raised 10 to 100 times whatever I got. But it worked because of that, because it was on YouTube and it was shared via Twitter and Facebook and so. If you run, I hope I can help you out, because I think there are ways of communicating with people now that you don't need television ads. And television advertising in politics is overrated, I think.
Well, the best response I got from anything was my little walk and talk.
Oh, right. Thing. Yeah. You did those.
I had a lot of people respond to my walk and talk stuff.
Yeah, I think more people elected. Should use that and use humor. People like humor. Yeah. And you can't be a buffoon, but using humor really, really cuts through the clutter.
Yeah, it does. Well, Mike, I can't tell you how thrilled I was to have you come up here. We got about 30 seconds before I have to get off the air, but I really appreciate it. I appreciate everything you did for Janet. And I love Bill Maher, so you are my hero.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to do it. I'm glad you have this platform. This is great.
And I took this platform. Obviously, I'm not making big bucks here either.
Right.
But I took this platform because one of the reasons why I got involved in politics is I thought that we needed people to hear the progressive viewpoint. Mm-hmm. And I was a progressive way before it became real popular. And it someday we'll get you in here and have you discuss why it's not socialism. Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Glenn Coble. We're on the program called A Progressive Life. Come on back.
Radio 107.1 FM, LP, Marion, Ohio. The Talking Place. The legendary attorney and representative of clients such as O.J. Simpson and Dr. Sam Shepard, F. Lee Bailey.
Let's talk about that. The day the verdict came back, Dr. Shepherd had been in prison over a decade at that point.
No, he was out on bail by then.
Oh, he was out on bail by then. Excuse me.
Yeah, but you're right. He was in prison for 10 years short 15 days.
That being said, when this came back, what was his feeling? What was your feeling that day?
Sam, who was sitting next to me, I had not put him on the stand, partly because he told his story so many times, telling it again wasn't going to make it much